we can handle a large number of rows. We have a higher row limit than I think any other spreadsheeting tool. Typically when you're doing virtualization in the DOM, right, you're putting a really tall div that's empty above the content that you're displaying. But with supporting hundreds of millions of rows or even billions of rows, you exceed what the maximum allowed height of a DOM element can be in the browser. You can't even leverage native scroll bars to be able to handle the virtualization.
Hey folks, welcome to episode 4 of the Browser Tech Podcast. For this episode, I spoke to Breck and Billy of Row Zero. Row Zero is a modern spreadsheet built to handle orders of magnitude more data than Excel while still being responsive. Naturally, it runs in the browser. We delved into the design decisions that make it work, from canvas rendering to the network architecture. Enjoy. Thanks for joining me, Breck and Billy. I would love to get started by just hearing about how you got started working on Row Zero.
Yeah, sure. The origin of the app is prior to Row Zero, I was a principal engineer for Amazon S3. I was working on the storage subsystem, and I spent a lot of time in Excel creating models of how the system worked in order to figure out where we could save costs. So most people don't realize how capital intensive of a business AWS or a storage service like S3 is, but they've got, you know, tens of millions of hard drives, hundreds of exabytes of data, and they're spending billions of dollars a year just on servers and routers and buildings, that sort of thing. And so the name of the game in a capital intensive business like that is to figure out how you can reduce costs every year. And as a result, I would spend a bunch of time in Excel creating these models to figure out what software investments we should make so that we could buy fewer or cheaper hard drives, that kind of thing. And it was through spending all that time in Excel that I got super frustrated with it. Three things in particular: Excel's performance, it's got this million row limit, its lack of kind of like native cloud connectivity, the data that I needed was in S3 or in databases or behind APIs. And then the last thing was just, if you wanted to do anything just a little more complicated than the Excel formula language, you had to use VBA, which is this like dinosaur language that nobody wants to use. And so I would have just wanted something else, like Python is what I really wanted. So yeah, that's the origin of the app, is just scratching the itch that I had as an engineer working on S3.
Got it. And so to describe the product itself, from my playing with it, it feels like just a really fast, like Excel on the web. I was about to compare it to Google Sheets, but I feel like that's kind of underselling the speed. Is that accurate?
I actually think that's a great comparison. The way I would describe ourselves is Google Sheets, but 1,000 times faster. So what we built looks and feels like Excel or Google Sheets, but it's browser-based like Google Sheets or Excel 365, which is the web version of Excel. But architecturally, it's very different. So Google Sheets, you know, many people think of it as a hosted product, but all the compute is actually happening in JavaScript on your laptop. And that's one of the reasons that it's so slow, and even so much slower than desktop Excel. Most serious spreadsheet users use desktop Excel, like all the New York iBankers or right there. None of them are using Google Sheets. And a big reason is performance. And with Row Zero, we don't run client side, we run in the cloud. So when you create a new workbook, we're spinning up compute in AWS behind the scenes, and we can scale that thing up as big as your model or your data set needs to be. And so that's really where we get the performance, is that one, we're not running in JavaScript, so we have some very clever software, which we can maybe get into a little more if you'd like, that's running in the cloud. It's written in Rust, so it's not happening in JavaScript in the browser. And two is, we're not constrained to the CPU and memory resources of your laptop. It's running on, you know, an arbitrarily large server in the cloud.
This makes so much sense. I was in finance before this, and like I would use Excel a lot, and I would hit that row limit very easily. And I was always thinking, why doesn't somebody just make Excel run in the cloud? And it sounds like that's what you've done. You've kind of put it on like some really powerful machine that's more powerful than what I'd have at my feet, certainly more powerful than WebAssembly would give you access to on the local machine. Yeah, that's really cool. In terms of spinning up that compute, I'm curious how that looks. So are you essentially spinning up like EC2 instances on the fly?
Yeah, that's right. We So yeah, there's kind of a few things that have been like building blocks that enable the service to exist now when maybe it wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago. So we are spinning up and down, you know, compute as users need it. And then kind of the second big thing is where we're spinning that compute up and down. So, you know, when you use Excel or any local application, it's very responsive. You know, when you hit a key, type in a formula and hit enter, you know, you get an instant answer. And the spreadsheet user interface, you know, sets that expectation that you're going to have this instant experience. But if we're putting that compute in the cloud, you know, every time you're typing in row zero and then hitting enter, that's a round trip to the cloud and back. And so isn't that going to feel slow? And so what we do to get around that is we spin up the compute or connect you to compute in the closest AWS region. And, you know, many people don't realize now AWS is in 30 different regions worldwide, not even counting their local zones. So if you count AWS local zones, which is like kind of like a baby AWS data center, they've got something like 60 more of those. So you're these days, you're really never more than a couple hundred miles from an AWS data center. And the speed of light is pretty fast. So, you know, we can go to the server and back and have it feel just like a native desktop application, but with way more compute and network connectivity behind it.
That's really interesting. So this reminds me actually more of like conversations that I've had with people doing pixel streaming, where they're kind of treating the server as where the application runs, and the client is really just a thin client, except instead of streaming pixels, you're streaming data by the looks of it.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, Billy can maybe go into more details about how the client rendering works. But yeah, that's the gist of it is, you know, we know what you're looking at on your screen. Like we know where your viewport is looking, like which cells in the spreadsheet are visible. And then we only have to send down the data that you're looking at. We don't, even though there might be, you know, multiple gigabytes on the server, you're only looking at maybe a few kilobytes at a time.
I see. So the server presumably has some sort of like view state representation for each connected client.
Yeah, or I think the server actually doesn't know, but the client in every request like tells the server where it is, and then the server can respond with the data that's there.
Got it. And if I take it, if multiple people are sort of have the same sheet open at a time, then they're talking to the same EC2 instance?
They are, yeah. So that's another really nice benefit of just doing everything in the server is it really simplifies multiplayer. So if you read about how Google makes their collaborative editing work, I'm not actually sure, I guess, what they're doing these days. I think they started with operational transformation or OT. Is this like one way to get that kind of concurrent editing? And then there's another family of data structures called CRDTs. So I'm not actually sure what Google's doing under the hood, but regardless of the approach, it's like very complicated software to get right to make that work. And for us, it is much simpler because we just have a transaction log. And so all the writes come to the server and kind of first one there wins. And, you know, there you can construct some like strange cases where maybe two people hit enter at the same time and it's not perfect in the way that a CRDT is, but those are very rare. And the simplification that you get from not having to build all that is well worth it.
Yeah, that's great. When it comes to like I noticed playing around with the app, it doesn't feel like I'm waiting for an EC2 instance to start. I work with EC2 a lot and, you know, instances take time to start. Do you just sort of have like a warm pool of instances or how do you work around that?
Yeah, we keep some compute warm so that users don't have to wait. A cold boot on an EC2 instance is like tens of seconds and it would feel too slow every time you hit new workbook, you had to wait.
Got it. Makes sense. And from talking to Billy earlier, it sounds like there's a lot of former Amazon AWS talent on the team. So it sounds like that's been you've made use of that.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, the team is all ex-principal engineers from S3 and Tableau. And then Billy and I worked together at a previous startup briefly. And then Billy spent a bunch of time at Airtable. So Billy is our client wizard. And then on the server side, it's the team that wrote the S3 file system. So not the original S3 file system that was written in 2006, but there was a rewrite to the S3 file system that started in about 2018 that replaced kind of the original S3 file system with a log structured file system to support high density drives. And our team was the team that led that implementation.
Well, that's a great segue actually to the client. I would love to hear more about sort of how the client's architected. Looks like you guys are not using the DOM. So I'd like to hear about that decision and how you kind of came on that.
Yeah, so we're using Canvas rendering. You know, we started out with DOM-based rendering, I think as anyone building something like this would do. But we ran into a few issues when building this spreadsheet, some of which are sort of actually comical and unique to the problem that we're solving. So, you know, for instance, we can handle a large number of rows, you know, more. We have a higher row limit than I think any other spreadsheeting tool. And we found that typically when you're doing, you know, like virtualization in the DOM, right, you're putting a really tall div that's empty above the content that you're displaying. And then the scroll bar, you're just sort of able to leverage the native scroll bar. But with, you know, supporting hundreds of millions of rows, or even billions of rows, and if you want that, you know, each row to be 20 pixels high, or, you know, they can customize it, you exceed what the maximum allowed height of a DOM element can be in the browser, which I didn't even know was a thing. I think it's, you know, it varies browser to browser, but it's something like 33.5 million pixels tall. So you get to this point where you can't even do, you know, basic, you know, I guess you can't leverage native scroll bars to be able to handle the virtualization without doing some sort of complex, okay, for every one pixel I scroll, I'll scroll 6 pixels in the sheet. So that was one thing where, you know, right off the bat, it's like, well, you know, if we were in Canvas land, we can sort of just define this for ourselves. And just benchmarking as we got into higher density grids of data, the Canvas sort of just really gave us that sort of edge we needed to be able to draw quickly. And, you know, like Breck was saying, because this is, you know, people have expectations about using a spreadsheet, right? People want to be able to, you know, quickly wheel around, quickly select content and drop frames just feel really bad. So I think we've been sort of very cognizant of building it with performance and, you know, FPS in mind, even though it's just a spreadsheet, you know, I think those interactions really, really seem to matter. So
have you found that you do sometimes still hit the frame budget when it's just text? Or do you find that like when you're just showing text at a regular resolution, you can kind of generally do that in a Canvas render without problems?
Yeah, text is the most expensive thing, right? So we found a few strategies to sort of combat this. So one thing we do is we're actually leveraging 3 overlapping canvases. So we found that if we can separate, you know, certain things that are being drawn, then we can re-render individual canvases and get improved performance. So for instance, if you're looking at a spreadsheet and you click in the middle of, you know, a cell, let's say G5, and then you spin your mouse around and you're sort of selecting, you know, this rectangle that's growing and changing. The contents of the cells aren't changing. You're not scrolling around. All you're really doing is, you know, selecting, you know, changing the background color or some selection box and border. So you don't need to be redrawing, you know, every text content in the page on every frame there. And if you have separate canvases, you can sort of do this thing where, okay, let's leave the text canvas untouched for now. And then let's just sort of repaint the, you know, the background canvas or some higher level canvas on top of that. And that's one way we've been able to sort of be clever about, you know, redrawing things when the canvas isn't changing in certain ways. Yeah, one technique. And then I guess also just with, you know, I think the most expensive thing, so drawing text and measuring text is really slow. So when you get into like text wrapping and just anything to do with text, you take all this for granted when you're working with a DOM because it all sort of just works. And then you have to re-implement it all from scratch yourself. But, you know, being able to cache, you know, measurements of text content based on certain font sizes and things like that, you know, because most of the time the user's staring at the same set of content, right? They're not scrolling around and constantly working all over the sheet. So you can sort of leverage that, you know, being in the same spot and sort of, you know, working and having already measured the content that you're going to be drawing again and again.
And how about when somebody's scrolling, do you find that you can reuse kind of the overlapping parts of the buffer at all, or is it easier there just to throw it out?
Yeah, so we're you know, grabbing more than just we need for the page. But I think one paradigm that we've had, at least when building this quickly, has been we want the rendering to be sort of like very bulletproof to, you know, I guess, rendering bugs that are caused from not properly cleaning up the previous state. So we wanted the sort of fast path render everything from scratch to be very very fast so that we can do that whenever we need. So, you know, that's why, for instance, when Breck was saying, is the server maintaining a reference for, you know, where what viewport every client is looking at? It's not, you know, we're just every individual request is self-describing. And then every time we get something back, we know exactly what we're drawing and we're able to sort of to draw very quickly and not worry about accidentally overriding. I think there's probably always more you can do. You can always be more clever about how you're moving things around and how you're drawing, especially with scrolling and being able to sort of, you know, just shift the entire canvas instead of redrawing from scratch. And I think, you know, it's something that we'll continue to improve upon. But another, you know, one name of the game here with just fast iteration is just being able to sort of not spend too much time on the low return optimizations to just be able to sort of build quickly. So this, our current architecture has sort of allowed us to, you know, add things, add features and add things that need to be drawn to the canvas pretty quickly and not worry about how we're handling complex edge cases because we're able to just draw quickly from scratch.
And I think that's something that game developers learned a long time ago. And then the creators of React copied to, like, getting into this world of, you know, partial repaint. It just, it's very complicated and bug prone. And it's just so much simpler to just say, this is my state. How do I paint the world?
Yeah, totally. And then in terms of like interactive components and things like that within the canvas, it sounds like all of that is kind of happening in canvas, including the scroll bar. So any, like, if I start editing text in a cell, is that all canvas or is there sort of a, like an input box
predicted
on top of that?
That's a great question. So the cell editing is just a native content editable. It's not an input because that's a whole other world, is building sort of a rich text editor from scratch and being able to reference content in the canvas is sort of a fun thing. But yeah, that's just a div that we overlay on top. So we sort of have, there's certain things, you know, if you click on a button, you want a popover to appear at this exact spot. So we sort of have a way of translating, you know, coordinates in the canvas to coordinates in the DOM to be able to position those. And then as the user's scrolling around, keep those updated, you know, every time we're drawing. And that's sort of, yeah, so we go from DOM land to canvas land for some of these interactions. Because I don't think we want to get in the business of rebuilding every popover and button and everything in canvas. And also just from an accessibility standpoint, you sort of get yourself into trouble real quick there. So yeah, the cell editing is just sort of perfectly laid on top. And you'll see, actually, if you look at most tools, this is, I think, a pretty common way of handling this. You get into fun with just making sure everything is positioned perfectly because you don't want pixels bleeding through and you want it to sort of be a seamless transition from canvas to DOM. But assuming your pixel math is correct, usually works out. Yeah.
Makes sense. Yeah. And are you doing then all of the click handling then is kind of handled in your code in the canvas coordinate space?
Yeah, exactly. So we have some layer that's basically given a point in the canvas, you know, what content could be under this. And it might be multiple things, right? Like if you're dealing with a cell that lives in a data table and it's a header cell, you know, when they click on that or right click on that, there's potentially multiple avenues that we might want to handle it. So we have, you know, a prioritization of what was clicked on. But yeah, so we're handling that all ourselves, which is, yeah, once again, you really appreciate how nice it is to just attach event listeners to a DOM element and not have to worry about the delegation yourself. But yeah, that's how we're handling it.
Got it. And it sounds like you're just doing this directly with Canvas APIs. You're not really using like a framework or library in between, or did you find anything helpful?
Yeah, I considered, there's a bunch of tools, especially in like the grid-based world. There's a lot of tools that have already been built that are doing canvas-based grid rendering. And we explored some of those. I think when you're building a new application from scratch, you hesitate to attach yourself to sort of an opinionated framework, especially early on, just because when you inevitably run into things that you want to build that don't quite fit within the confines or the constraints of that library, you sort of have to figure out clever workarounds versus being able to just sort of architect it the exact way you'd want. So that's one reason I think we ended up just sort of going with our own solution. And then as far as more generic canvas rendering libraries, we are not using any, but I think there's, you know, so we're doing 2D based rendering. I think there's, you know, maybe a future world where we We're using WebGL rendering context to get even more performance out of things. I think handling fonts and texts is something I would need to look into more before we bite that off. But yeah, we sort of figured that it's nicer to be able to just be in full control. And the things that we're building are not so complex that we're in sort of a great need of a framework for this that we can't just build ourselves.
Yeah, to add on to that, another thing that we're just super conscious about is page weight. And this is something that we sort of learned firsthand. So the startup that Billy and I worked at previously was called ShoeFitter, and that was acquired by Amazon. And so our team spent a bunch of time shipping Amazon detail page features. And Amazon has this like very rich A/B testing machinery internally for experimenting with features as they roll them out. And I think Amazon, more than any other maybe software builder in the world, has shown the impact that latency has on people's tendency to buy less on a retail site. And the number one driver of latency is just page weight. And so if you just ship less and have fewer libraries and dependencies, your app is going to be faster. So I think it's been a few months since I checked, but I think our whole app, which includes like CodeMirror as a code editor, all the rendering stuff that Billy just described, the full spreadsheet, I think we're under a meg. And I think the last time I checked CNN, it was like 30 megs if you have an ad blocker mm-hmm. turned off. And what we're doing is way more complicated than that. So I think, yeah, I'm pretty proud of how slim we've kept the front end payload.
It's great. It's really nice to work in a place where there's emphasis on this, because I've worked in Wild West companies where, you know, teams are bringing in new NPM dependencies left, right, and center, and no one's really checking that. So I think it's a good paradigm to have.
Yeah, it really shows through both in your landing page and in the application itself. It feels very snappy in a way that's not always true, even of products that understand the browser really well. Like, I think there is just this tendency to just bundle more in. It only needs to be loaded once, but it really does make a good first impression when stuff just loads quickly.
Yeah, even just download time, like when you have more code in the app that is like pulling in all these bundles, there's also like cache locality consequences to that. So it's not just like, well, we downloaded 10 megs of JavaScript, but well, once it's loaded, then it's all the same. Like that's not true, because there's all this code that has to fit in your caches as this thing is executing, and you'll feel the difference between that app that's one page like after, or one meg, excuse me, after the page load, not just at page load time.
So yeah, we talked about network on the code itself. I'm curious about network on the data layer. Billy, you mentioned requests before, sort of as you're scrolling, there's requests. Are those like standalone requests, or is that like a WebSocket type thing, or what?
Yeah, we've got a WebSocket hooked up. So when you connect to your instance, you know, we're setting up a WebSocket, and then that's what we're using as our means of communication for, you know, both just asking for data and then also multiplayer edits, you know, being force repaints, et cetera, things coming down from the server. So we're using WebSockets and, you know, gzipping are to be super small and super efficient so that we can sort of send down a full screen of data and it won't be problematic for the client to unpack and draw.
Got it. And is the payload itself that's being gzipped, is it just raw JSON, or are you using like message pack or anything fancy like that?
Yeah, just JSON payloads with sort of, yeah, trying to keep things as efficient as possible. But yeah, just JSON.
Cool. Yeah, it makes sense to piggyback on the browser's really fast JSON loading capabilities. Are you using any WebAssembly on the client side, or is the client side all JavaScript?
Yeah, Breck, do you want to talk about our WebAssembly formula editor?
Yeah, sure. I can take that. So we do have some WebAssembly. Not for any compute though. So where we do use it is, you know, you can type formulas on the client. Like if you say like equals sum, like A1 colon A10, you've now typed a formula and we want to be able to provide some syntax highlighting. Well, that formula parser is a non-trivial piece of code. And we also need to be able to parse formulas on the server to, you know, build the AST of your expression and then know how to execute it. And so you don't want to write that twice. And so the backend is written in Rust, and Rust has great WebAssembly support. So we actually just use the one authoritative implementation, server-side implementation of the parser, and then just ship that down to the client. Then the client hands the little string into that WebAssembly function, which then returns, you know, these are the parts of the formula. So, you know, we can highlight the cell references as blue or that kind of thing.
Got it. And so, yeah, you mentioned that was not performance driven, but was Rust itself on the back end? Was that a performance driven concern, or did you just like working with Rust?
It was a performance and correctness thing. It was also a bit of a familiarity thing. So the, like I think I mentioned earlier, the team wrote this S3 file system, and that was kind of the first big mission critical Rust project at Amazon. So the team had a bunch of Rust expertise, and so we knew it well. But one of the things we learned doing the S3 file system was that Rust can be very performant. Like the real reason we chose it for S3 was not like just the speed of the implementation, but the fact that it doesn't do, you know, mark and sweep GC. And even though that's gotten significantly better in the newer versions of Java, there's still, you know, this tail that you have to worry about in any, you know, traditionally garbage collected language, and the Rust tail is much, much tighter. And then the second thing is Rust just interops really well with, you know, these system libraries. So under the hood, when you create an object in Rust, you know, there's so much overhead to doing that in Java. Like I think the size of an integer in Java is something like 28 bytes or something, even though you should only need like 8 bytes to actually store the thing. And that overhead adds up a ton. And so Rust gives you this really nice kind of ergonomic language that feels like you're writing in a higher level language, like, you know, ML or Haskell, but with the performance characteristics of a C or a C++.
Another kind of architectural question. You're able to deal with massive data sets and pull them in from S3, you mentioned, and things like that. Do you need to load all that data into memory, or do you kind of load it chunk at a time, or how does that work?
Yeah, currently we just load it all into memory. We have some ideas for how we could be kind of more clever about this for larger than memory data sets, but memory can get quite large. Like there are EC2 instances with 16 terabytes of RAM, and I don't think we have anybody using that much data in the app today, but it's possible. And so there's a great post by the creator of DuckDB, did about a year ago, Jordan, called Big Data is Dead. And in that post, he sort of asked this question, like, is your data set really too big for RAM? Or do you really need to be going to solutions like BigQuery and Snowflake and, you know, distributing your workloads to answer the data? And there's this, I think he calls them the data 1%. There's like a handful of workloads in the world that, yes, these truly need to be distributed workloads. But if you're not sure if your data in the 1%, you're not. And the vast majority of us, you know, you can do quite a lot with 10 gigs in memory, and then it's also super fast and responsive.
And then I guess loading, because you're typically loading data from data that's already in an Amazon data center, it seems like the network between where the data actually is and the machine that's running it that's not a big problem for you.
Yeah, there's some really fat pipes between EC2 and S3.
And it doesn't seem to matter then even like which region the data happens to reside in. You're optimizing for latency to the end user.
We do. I mean, yeah, we do. There are also fat pipes between the Amazon data centers. There is some cost to that. We generally are compressing data before it moves between data centers. Like Parquet is very space efficient format. But even so, if you created an S3 bucket in like one of the India regions and then tried to load that in US East 1, you'll notice like that's, you know, it's not as bad as, you know, being on your phone, maybe in India, trying to talk to a US website. It's still going to be slower than if you're sitting in the same data center.
Yeah, so this sounds great. What's next for you guys?
So we launched officially a couple of weeks ago on Hacker News and got some great feedback. Much of the feedback was just asking for more spreadsheet features and more connectors to different data sources like ERPs, like NetSuite, and some of the databases that we haven't built native connectors for yet, like Azure Synapse and BigQuery. So that's what the team is focused on right now, as well as, I guess the last thing I'll say is private hosting was a big one. So today, to use the app, we're like a SaaS app, you know, you upload your data to us, we host it securely. And there's a class of customers, particularly in the finance and healthcare spaces, who would like to be able to use our service, but running it on their own AWS infrastructure.
And is there anything else you'd like people to know?
Yeah, just that if you are currently someone who has data in AWS, either in Snowflake or a Redshift database, or you have data in S3, if you're currently downloading that data and ever opening it in Excel, you should give Row Zero a try. I think we're a much better experience than what you're doing today.
Great. Well, thank you, Billy and Breck. This was a fascinating discussion.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, this is great. Appreciate it.
That was my conversation with Breck and Billy of Row Zero. To learn more about Row Zero, go to rowzero.io. They even let you try it out without signing up, which I love. For more browser tech stuff, check out browsertech.com. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to the Browser Tech Podcast at podcast.browsertech.com or by searching Browser Tech in your podcast app. Browser Tech is brought to you by Jamsocket. Jamsocket makes it easy to deploy applications where each user gets a dedicated process, not so different from the architecture you heard about today. Learn more at jamsocket.com. I'm your host, Paul. You can find me at PaulGB on Twitter.